I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is writer, commentator, and religious studies scholar Reza Aslan. He's joined in conversation by Rabbi Sidney Mintz of Congregation Emmanuel in San Francisco. And now, join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Reza Aslan and Rabbi Sidney Mintz.
Reza Aslan is here with us this evening. He is an acclaimed writer and scholar of religions, whose books include No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam, and the number one New York Times bestselling Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. He's also the author of How to Win a Cosmic War, God, Globalization, and the End of the War on Terror, as well as the editor of Tablet and Pen, Literary Landscapes from the Modern Middle East. Reza frequently appears on major news networks as a guest commentator, as well as consulting, he was a consulting producer on the HBO series The Leftovers, and host of Rough Draft with Reza Aslan, and the CNN documentary series Believer. He's here tonight, along with Congregation Emmanuel's Rabbi Sidney Mintz, to discuss God, a Human History, an exploration of humanity's quest to make sense of the divine, and a call for us to embrace a deeper, more expansive understanding of God. Let's give them a warm welcome. Thank you.
All right.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, how's everybody doing tonight?
All right.
Excited?
Yeah. Let's talk about God.
Let's talk about God.
What could go wrong?
One of my all-time favorite subjects. So, I have had a chance to read the book.
Oh, good.
And it's good.
That's an unusual experience for me.
I will say that I was a little intimidated at first because I thought it was a 300-page book about God.
It's like 200 pages of notes.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's the kicker, that it's only 179 pages and there's a big bibliography in
yeah.
notes. So don't be intimidated by it. But before we really delve into what obviously I find is a fascinating subject, I wanted to ask you a couple questions about yourself because you're a fascinating guy.
Oh, okay.
So my first question for you is, what was it like where you grew up? Where did you grow up? What were some of the most formative experiences in those first years?
Well, I was born in Iran. I come from, you know, a fairly culturally, you know, Muslim family, the way so many people are culturally religious. My father, I think I had mentioned this last time that I was here, my father was a kind of a rabid atheist, you know, like one of those, like the annoying kind of atheist. You know, like the atheist who always had a pocket full of Prophet Muhammad jokes that he would pull out at inappropriate times. You know, like that kind of atheist. And so when the revolution happened in 79, which, you know, people, I think so much time has passed, they misunderstand what that was. We call it an Islamic revolution. It was not an Islamic revolution. It was a leftist revolution that a year later became the Islamic Republic. But at the time, you know, my dad kind of looked at what was going on and he just thought, I don't trust any of these people with turbans on, so let's just leave for a while until things settle down. And obviously, things did not settle down. We grew up here in the Bay Area. I grew up mostly in San Jose. Used to live in the Castro and in Oakland, and this is still, you know, still feels like home to me. This was the 1980s, which was the height of the Iran hostage crisis. So it wasn't, you know, the best time to be either Iranian or Muslim in America.
Unlike now.
But it's great now. Everything has been fixed. I've said on many occasions that I spent like a good part of the 1980s pretending to be Mexican, mm-hmm. which tells you how little I understood America, mm-hmm. right?
Also much better now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we took care of those two problems. I've always been fascinated by religion and by spirituality. Again, I didn't really grow up in a religious household, and certainly when we came to America, you know, that was kind of my dad's excuse for just wiping our house clean of religion mm-hmm. altogether. But I think that those childhood images that I had of revolutionary Iran really, they never left me. They really gave me an abiding interest in the power of religion. And then when I was in 15 years old, I went with some friends to an evangelical youth camp in Northern California, and I heard the gospel story for the first time, this amazing story about how the God of heaven and earth came down in the form of a baby and how he died for our sins, and this promise that anybody who believes in him would never die and have eternal life. I'd never heard anything like that before in my life. That was it was a profound experience for me, and I converted to this particularly conservative brand of evangelical Christianity, and then spent the next 4 years preaching that gospel to everybody I met, whether they wanted to hear it or not, frankly.
What was that like for your family?
It was weird. My dad was just like, oh, God, like, how do, like, we left Iran and this is what happens, you know? This is not what I had
it's
in
like
mind.
It's like the American dream gone bad.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
My mom, she still prayed once in a while and she still maintained a little bit of a religious life. And the thing about this brand of Christianity is that it's all about converting other people. Like it's an existential thing, right? That you have to go out and you have to convert other people, and certainly your family is first. So I did. I converted my mother. And I converted my little sister, and my mother's still a pretty faithful Christian. My little sister is now a hijabi Muslim, which is funny. I don't know how that happened. She's the only one of us born here in America. So we're like, you're already set. Like, why are you, like, you're fine.
In those first 7 years, like, if I went back, what was the town you were born in?
Tehran.
You were so not a town, a city.
Yeah.
So you were in the big city of Tehran. If I went back to Tehran and found some of the people from your first 7 years of life and I interviewed them now, do you think that they had any idea then that you would be sitting in a Jewish community center in San Francisco being interviewed by a lesbian rabbi about a book that you wrote about God?
Yeah, totally. I think that they would have been like, well, obviously.
They saw that in you as a seven-year-old prodigy. Yeah.
So it's so clear.
Uh-huh. Our country more and more should be talking about the evolution of religion, and instead I find that a lot of us are stuck in our own identities without being able to come out and speak about it or reach across any aisle and talk.
And that's absolutely – I mean, that was kind of my experience too, because I grew up in that kind of – well, not grew up, but I mean from high school, that was mm-hmm. the kind of community that I belonged to. When I went to college and decided that I was going to study religion – for a living, I had that experience that everybody has when they go to college, when you realize everything that you have ever been taught was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, oh, everything I know is false.
You hope so.
I think what happened then is as I began to study the religions of the world and I began to understand the difference between religion and faith and the idea of religion as a language of metaphors, the metaphors of Christianity just didn't work for me anymore. I went to a Jesuit university, and if you know anything about the Jesuits, you know that they are troublemakers,
mm-hmm.
And they love the drink. Mm-hmm. Those are the two things that you need to know about the Jesuits.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like a great education.
Yeah, it's really, the Jesuit parties were the best parties. Yes? Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. They had all the best drinks. And they encouraged me. They said, you know, well, if this isn't working for you, I mean, what about the religion of your forefathers? And I was like, I actually don't know anything about that. And And they gave me some books to read, and I started, you know, reading it. And again, it was sort of those metaphors started to make more sense. So I often say that I had an emotional conversion to Christianity, and I had an intellectual conversion to Islam.
By the Jesuits.
By the Jesuits.
See, this is getting more interesting.
I told you, they're troublemakers.
Right, we don't have to talk about the book. This is just fascinating enough. So
just, yeah.
You then basically converted back to your...
Converted back to
your family faith.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Specifically, the Sufi tradition within Islam. That's my branch. That's the tradition that I think gravitate towards. And then went back to my family, and my dad was like, "This isn't better. This is worse, actually."
Uh-huh.
And my mother mourned and freaked out. And then I think my little sister was like, "Well, that seems a thing. I'll do that too." Mm-hmm. I feel like I could get my sister to convert to anything at this point. Yeah,
I say leave her be at this point.
Yeah, probably just
she's
fine.
Been through enough. She's been through enough. But a real trailblazer.
Yeah.
So what would you say led you, if you had gone to more of an intellectual conversion to Islam or back to Islam, mm-hmm. that led you to write Zealot? What was it about Christianity that wanted to explain to people who didn't know that much? I mean, it was. I said to Reza, "It's my favorite book about Jesus Christ," and the other one that I read was the New Testament. So, yeah.
That's a great endorsement.
So it's much better.
Yeah.
I think it's more readable.
I feel like mine holds together better.
A little bit better.
Somehow,
yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. No. Well, I think what happened was, so in the I want to emphasize that I was introduced to Christianity through a very conservative, evangelical, fundamentalist, literalist mm-hmm. version of it. Had I been introduced to Christianity, you know, by like the Lutherans or something, I probably would be in a different place. But, you know, the foundation of that kind of Christianity is this notion of, you know, literal text, inerrant text. And it only takes really about 5 minutes of study of the Bible to know that the Bible is full of errors, as it should be. Of course it is. It's written through, you know, thousands of years by dozens of hands. Of course it's full of errors.
You mean divergences?
Yes, divergences, yes.
Or interpretations.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so that I think is part of why that faith collapsed, because it was built on not a strong foundation. But I think what happened was that as I began to study Jesus in his historical context, once I stopped thinking of Jesus as God incarnate mm-hmm. and then started thinking of him as a person who lived in a specific time and place and who did some extraordinary things that have made him, you know, this you know, who he is, what I realized was that Jesus was better. Like mm-hmm. it was so much more interesting. He was so much more worth knowing and following. And so in this weird way, when I abandoned Christianity, I became kind of an even more devout follower of Jesus. Mm-hmm. You know, when I stopped seeing him as the Christ mm-hmm. and started seeing him as this, you know, Nazarene, this
person.
This impoverished Jewish day laborer from the backwoods of Galilee, suddenly my experience of him was transformed, and for the better. And that was why I wanted to write Zealot, to give everybody else that experience.
Mm-hmm. What led you from that fascination with Jesus and writing Zealot to this work, which is, the sequel. God comes after Jesus. Don't tell God that.
Yeah.
But the subtext here is a human history.
Yeah.
And so tell us a little bit about what does it mean, a human history?
So the thesis of the book is that the entirety of the history of human spirituality can be viewed as one long, interconnected ever-evolving, remarkably cohesive attempt to make sense of God by giving God human emotions and human motivations, human attributes, a human personality, human virtues and vices, human strengths and weaknesses, essentially by transforming God into a human. And that process that can be traced all the way back to the very, you know, rise of the concept of God, that it's part of how our brains work. It's deeply embedded in our cognitive processes. We have no choice but to do that. And that there are these, you know, pretty bad consequences of that kind of cognitive impulse. I mean, that are obvious, that if you're essentially conceiving of God as a divine reflection of yourself, if you're projecting upon God everything that you love and everything that you hate, then, you know, you're not just divinizing yourself, but you're creating this superhuman being with human foibles, but without human limitations. And that, more than anything else, I think explains the conflicts of religions that we see in the world. And to your question about why the bridge between Zealot and this, because of all, and this is something that all religions do this, Eastern or Western, historically. In fact, what's really fascinating is that studies show that atheists do it too. That if you ask an atheist, okay, fine, you don't believe in God, but describe what you mean by God, they do what everyone does. They describe a divine version of themselves. And I was thinking about sort of why is it that Christianity is so successful? Why is it the largest, most successful religion in the history of the world and will likely continue to be for quite some time? Why? And the thought occurred to me that it's because it has fully abandoned itself to this cognitive impulse. You know, what Christianity says is not that God has human attributes, it's that God is literally a human being. And so this fundamental question that people of faith or without faith have been asking themselves, you know, from the beginning of time, which is, what is God? What is God? Christianity's answer to that is about as simple as it gets. Just imagine the most perfect human being, that's God.
Except in Christianity, it's just one human being.
One human being, one specific
human
being.
Just one specific human being.
At one time in history.
Which is very particularistic and very much a part of that history versus
that's right.
The universalism, I think, that you get to. I don't want to spoiler alert. Mm-hmm. There is actually
don't give away the ending.
You mean that we are God?
That we are God.
Might seem very controversial to somebody who fundamentally believes that there was one person who was God.
Right.
Or only believes, in a monotheistic way, in a God out there.
By the way, let me just clarify one very important thing about this, the idea of the incarnation. Because, you know, a lot of people will say, well, the idea of a human being who is God is an old idea. There are countless examples of that going all the way back to Sargon of Akkad, right, who was the first, the great Akkadian king, mm-hmm. who was the first to accept divine status. Most of the pharaohs were considered to be living gods, though it's a little more complicated than that. Many of the Roman emperors were considered to be divine. Most of them were considered to become gods after they died, but a good number of them, more than a dozen of them, were considered to be divine while they lived. And in fact, some of their family members were mm-hmm. considered to be divine while they lived. So what's unique about Christianity and its conception of the incarnation isn't that they think of God as a human being. This is what's unique about it, is that they think that the only God in the universe is a singular human mm-hmm. being, right? I mean, Caesar was a god, but there were other gods, mm-hmm. right? But for a monotheistic religion to say the one God of heaven and earth, the only God that exists, was for a brief time a person. That there is no, there's no other example of that. There's nothing else that I can think of that even comes close to that, that kind of a theological idea.
Yeah. Well, you point out in the book that, you know, from Adam and Eve, from the very first people, if you think of them as literally the very first people, that there was a universal sense that there was something outside of us, that we were bodies, but we were animated by the soul, and that the soul somehow was transcendent. And that recognition, you said that that might be the first consciousness, the first recognition.
That's right.
That led people to the creation of a humanized God.
The first belief, the first belief.
You're listening to writer, commentator, and religious studies scholar Reza Aslan, whose new book is God, A Human History. He's joined in conversation by Rabbi Sidney Mintz on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Now, I use soul anachronistically. I just want to make it clear, you know, that I'm using the word soul as a stand-in for the idea of an immaterial self, you know, a spiritual essence, however you want to define that. But, you know, the question of the origins of the religious impulse is one that, that we've been fascinated by for a couple of hundred years now, you know, trying to figure out, where did religion come from? Why did it arise? Or was our species the only species to express religious belief, or can it be understood in previous species of humans? And this question has been around for a long, long time. We, you know, we've been exploring it and trying to come up with some kind of answer for it for centuries now. Usually the way that we do so is by relying on material evidence. I mean, that's kind of the trade that we engage in. You dig something up out of the earth, you date it, and then you interpret it, and then you make some sort of grand theory about what this says about, you know, how far religion can go back. And we have a ton of stuff. I mean, we have so much material that we have found, not just, you know, the spectacularly painted caves of Europe and Asia, which clearly indicate a religious function. I mean, that that debate has been put to rest, more or less. There are still some scholars who say that it's just caveman graffiti. That's, that's all that is. But they're definitely the marginalized
voice.
Those
are the ones who don't believe in global warming also.
Exactly right. Yeah. We have countless graves. I mean, that's our treasure trove of information about prehistoric spirituality. Understand that just the fact that we buried our dead in and of itself is an indication of some kind of spiritual awareness, because there is no reason to bury the dead. It is extremely materially expensive, particularly at a time in which our focus should be on survival, to go through the process of just even burying a dead person. But the important thing is, you know, we have discovered signs of unambiguous ritual experience in the graves that we have dug up. And that includes certainly Homo sapien graves, but it includes Neanderthal graves and, in a number of occasions, even Homo erectus graves.
I found that to be incredibly fascinating.
Yeah, just that it goes beyond us.
It goes beyond us, but that that is an expression of the belief or the desire to have a soul that is released. If your body is in the ground, there's something else happening.
And it's not just in the ground. It's in the ground with tools
with your stuff.
And weapons, your stuff, exactly. That in and of itself tells us, oh, they believed that this wasn't it, that something continued after this. And so we use the word soul in order to make sense of that thing that they thought continued. But that shows unambiguous signs of religious activity. But here's the point of all of this, is that, you know, we can do this all day. We can talk about the stuff that we have found. We can keep dating it. The dates change constantly. We used to think that the oldest painted caves were 40,000 years old. So that's just around the time that Homo sapiens arrived in Europe. And now we have found caves that are 43, 44,000 years old. So that means they were painted by Neanderthals before we even showed up. We used to think that Homo sapiens were the only ones who buried their dead in ritualistic fashion. We have found now countless Neanderthal bodies in sort of modern day Israel, Jordan area that show the same symbols of ritual belief. We've found dozens and dozens of idols, you know, carved talismans, figures that clearly show that they were meant for some kind of ceremonial or ritual purpose. And we used to think, okay, well, for sure we could find that with Homo sapiens. Then we started finding ones from Neanderthals, and we're like, wow, that's interesting. And now we've begun to find carved idols that are at least 300,000 years old. So just to be clear, that's 100,000 years before we existed as a species. All of this is to say that whatever this is, whatever the religious impulse is, however you want to define it, it goes back before we even existed. It's a part of who we are. It's embedded in our cognitive processes. Why? Well, I don't know.
Well, thank you very much.
Nobody knows. Nobody knows why.
Well, take us then and leap forward from that understanding that there was a soul to the belief in God. That's jumping ahead a few chapters, but right. We have to be out of here by midnight.
Let's start with where we left off.
That's why you guys came, right? God.
Yeah. That's right.
Yes.
Let's start with where we left off. Okay, so if the religious impulse is a cognitive impulse, mm-hmm. it's embedded in our brains, it's part of our evolution. It's who we are as human mm-hmm. beings. Why? We can talk about that. There are a number of theories. They're all equally good, and they're all equally unprovable. But that's the first thing that we have to understand. So then how do we get from that to deities? And that's where this whole impulse, this humanizing impulse that I was talking about, starts to kick in. Because as we begin to express this fundamental idea, this fundamental religious impulse that we have, as we begin to express it, we have no choice but to use ourselves as the lens through which we express it, through which we understand it. So as we begin to create theories about the workings of the universe, about the reasons for natural phenomena, we begin to humanize or anthropomorphize those phenomena until eventually we create beings who start to look and act and feel and think exactly the way that we do. And then a couple of 100,000 years pass and this starts to express itself figuratively, whether it's we start to paint our concepts of the divine, or we begin to carve our concepts of the divine, or ultimately we discover writing and we begin to write about our concepts of the divine. And in each one of these steps, that unconscious, innate compulsion to humanize the divine becomes more and more actualized until ultimately God is just a guy who looks exactly like we do, who acts exactly like we do, who thinks exactly like we think, but who just has superpowers. And it's an inevitable progression.
A supernaturalized
God. That's right, a supernaturalized God, precisely, mm-hmm. yeah.
Mm-hmm. I, of course, was fascinated by your chapter about me. About the Jews.
Yes.
About the Jews. That When you got to that chapter, for me, when you unpacked from your perspective the what we call God,
yeah.
the idea of El, the idea of El Shaddai, the idea of Yahweh, and then finally, and are you familiar with Eheyeh Asher Eheyeh in the Bible? It is what God tells Moses to tell the people, and it
I
is
am
this.
Who I am. I am what I am. I am what I will be.
Right.
I am what I was.
Which is,
yeah.
I think, a much more complex version
yeah.
of this belief than I'm El Shaddai, I'm El, I'm Elohim, mm-hmm. I am Adonai, I'm Yahweh. And I'd like to ask you what you think about translating Eheyeh Asher Eheyeh, which is just one of the names of God,
yeah.
To I will be what you make of me.
Yeah, so this is it. I mean, it's one of those fantastic Hebrew phrases that can mean 40 different things, right?
That's like the three Jews, seven opinions.
Yeah, exactly.
The one name of God, seven different meanings.
And yeah. And it comes at this pivotal moment, mm-hmm. right, in which Moses, for the first time, and I think this is where the controversy and the problems mm-hmm. arise with this interpretation, but for the first time mm-hmm. meets this brand new God,
mm-hmm.
a God that has never entered history, a God that in the history of Israel had never existed before. Yahweh was unknown to Abraham and mm-hmm. to his kin. And that makes sense mm-hmm. because these are people who lived their entire lives in the land of Canaan. And Yahweh is an Egyptian deity, well, a Median deity, mm-hmm. but that's pretty much Egypt now.
But that was Moses' yiches. That was Moses'
lineage. Which makes sense,
because
that's what Moses was.
Yes,
exactly.
And also he married a Midianite.
And he married a Midianite.
Mm-hmm.
And
we don't like to tell people that, but Moses
yeah.
married a Midianite.
He married a Midianite.
Daughter.
He lived in the land of Midian.
Mm-hmm.
His father-in-law was a priest of Midian. The land of the Midianites is as we have a I think it's a 14th century Egyptian text that refers to that land as the land of the people of the Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
And so here is this person who meets this never before seen Egyptian deity, basically. And you know, the compilers of the text have to figure out a way to make sense of this, because what's the first thing besides, you know, after he introduces himself, mm-hmm. he says, I am the God mm-hmm. of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. They did not know me as Yahweh, mm-hmm. but I am that God.
I'm the same guy.
I'm the same God, mm-hmm. though they did not know me as that. And so you see this incredibly fascinating attempt to connect these two different religious traditions as one, for obvious reasons. And is, as I explained in the book, it's really the sort of the story of monotheism as we know it is the story of the merging of these two quite different gods, the God of Abraham, El, and the God of Moses, Yahweh.
Mm-hmm. People might find some of the things that you say in general controversial.
I can't imagine
but,
why.
In here, I want to read something that I found to be fascinating about the birth of Judaism. And Reza writes, "This is the birth of Judaism as we know it, not in the covenant with Abraham, nor in the Exodus from Egypt, but in the smoldering ashes of a razed temple and the refusal of a defeated people to accept the possibility of a defeated God. The very testament of faith in Judaism, known as the Shema, was composed after this transformational moment in Israelite history, as was most of what we know today as the Hebrew Bible." Tell
yes.
us more about that. Why do you see that
and
as
that
the
moment
birth of Judaism?
That moment in history is
mm-hmm.
the Babylonian exile.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important to understand, again, that Abraham was not a monotheist.
Mm-hmm.
Moses was not a monotheist. At best, these two individuals practice what we would now refer to as monolatry, the belief that there is one high God who is above all other gods, and the sole God that you worship but there are other gods.
Mm-hmm. Which continued for generations.
For generations.
Rachel, Abraham's granddaughter. She went and she had to get her household idols before she left her father's home.
We actually know that in the first temple, there were many gods that were represented in the first temple, mm-hmm. including Baal. Essentially what the early Israelites, and by the way, there was nothing different about the early Israelites. That's how everyone thought. I mean, everyone just assumed that your God is the highest God, but there are other gods. And so that's the first thing that you need to know. So before any of this makes sense, the second thing that you need to know is that warfare in the ancient Near East was not considered a battle between armies and nations and tribes. That's not how the ancient people of that region understood war. War was a battle between gods. Mm-hmm. And again, when you go back and you read the Hebrew scriptures, particularly when you read the histories of the early wars of ancient Israel, they are all presented in that way. I mean, they're verses that literally say, and God killed more of the enemy on the battlefield than did the people of Israel. You know, there's the most fantastic line, right? That moment in which the Israelites are facing the army of Egypt. And what does God say? Be still. Just be still. Know that I'm God. Mm-hmm. I'll take care of it. And at times, this idea that God is the warrior, God is the one who's doing the fighting, you're just the pawns that he uses in order to do the fighting, sometimes creates these, you know, kind of hilarious moments, right? As in when God tells David, you know, in the battle of the Philistines, right? David says, Should I attack them now, Lord? And God goes, No, don't go this way. Go around the back. Make sure to go around the balsam woods. Come around this way. Like he's an actual general, like a field general, you know, telling you exactly what to do. That's how everyone thought. It was a standard belief system in the ancient Near East. But it carried with it this very grave consequence, which is that when you lost a war, that meant that God killed your God. And so throughout the Hebrew scriptures, when the Israelites defeat the Philistines, it's always, you know, our God defeated Dagon, the god mm-hmm. of the Philistines. But then when the Babylonians show up and kill everyone, destroy Jerusalem, burn the temple to the ground, scatter what's left of the Israelites into the Babylonian captivity, the only theological conclusion there is that Marduk, the god of Babylon, just killed Yahweh, the god of Israel. And the truth of the matter is that was the primary view. You know, we have ample evidence that most of the Jews in exile took Babylonian names. Mm-hmm. They started reading Babylonian scriptures. They began worshiping Babylonian gods because that was the logical conclusion. But among those Jews in exile, there was this one group of Jews, and it's most clearly represented by the writings of who we call Second Isaiah, right? The book of Isaiah is actually three books, the first Isaiah, Second Isaiah, and Third Isaiah. The guy who was Second Isaiah, that group had a completely different idea, a brand new idea, an idea that had never worked before. And that idea was, maybe Marduk didn't kill Yahweh. Maybe there is no Marduk. Maybe all of this is because Yahweh is punishing us for having believed in Marduk in the first place. And it's at that moment in which what we now call monotheism mm-hmm. first stuck. I want to emphasize.
That's radical.
It's radical.
That's
it's
radical.
Huge.
I didn't learn that in rabbinical school or religious school
in
Chicago.
It's a huge idea.
That is a radical and controversial idea about identity formation.
And by the way, it's not that the idea of monotheism hadn't arisen before. It did. It just was struck down immediately, always, because it doesn't make sense. The human mind The ancient mind could not understand why there would be one God. It makes no sense. And part of it has to do with this humanization thing that we've been talking about, right? That we are perfectly willing to accept the presence of conflicting and contradictory attributes and emotions within ourselves, but we can't accept that in a singular God. It makes much more sense to have a God for each one of our attributes, a God of war and a God of love and a God of, a fatherly God and a motherly God. The idea that a good God, a bad God, like to have all of that in one God did not make sense in the ancient mind. And the reason that it finally took is that this is a people who were facing, as you rightly said, an existential crisis. Either all of this is over, and there is no more Yahweh, and therefore no more Israel, and no more, if you want to call it Judaism, mm-hmm. I don't know if I would call it Judaism at that point, but no more Judaism. Mm-hmm. Or we are willing to actually entertain this impossible idea, which is that there's only one God, our God, and that, yes, he has all the attributes, good and bad, right? No evil befalls a city unless Yahweh does it, mm-hmm. the scriptures say. So all of those things that kept monotheism at bay for so many centuries suddenly are accepted because the alternative is unthinkable.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features writer, commentator, and religious studies scholar Reza Aslan, whose new book is God, A Human History. He's joined in conversation by Rabbi Sidney Mintz. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
You're starting to sound kind of 2017-ish now.
Sort of, yeah.
The alternative is unthinkable.
Yeah.
And, you know, using the words existential crisis. So
we are definitely in a moment of existential crisis.
I think the world is. I think our country is. And so, you know, beyond page 179, talk to us and tell us what you think about the relationship between religion and America today. You are not only an expert in the Middle East, but you are an Iranian-American. You're a Muslim. What do you see from your vantage point is happening in terms of spiritual religious crisis in the face of the ascendancy of Trump? And I know we're not supposed to talk about Trump because Trump's not God.
Yeah.
But
he who shall not be named.
Right, like Voldemort. We'll just call him that.
Yeah, I don't want to bring these people down.
We're already there, man. We are already there. No, but
what I can say is that it's way worse than you think it is.
wow.
Look, yeah, it's way way worse than you.
We're
going
to need more than chai after this.
Yeah, exactly.
But what about Israel? Is America experiencing not just a political but a religious crisis
Absolutely.
As well in terms of the
there's
relationship?
There's no question about it. And by the way, it's important to understand that America is a deeply religious country, but 71% of us are Christian. So it's a specific kind of religion that we express, that we espouse as a country. And among that 70% is what I can only describe as a kind of existential crisis right now. Most of you know this stuff. 81% of white evangelicals voted for Donald Trump. That's a record. That's more white evangelicals than voted for George W. Bush, who was a white evangelical. To this day, as Trump's support in almost every category has just been deteriorating, his support among white evangelicals has barely waned. The PRRI, the Public Religion Research Institute, just released a report that said 75%, so three-quarters of white evangelicals strongly approve of Donald Trump. And I think even more disturbing, among those three-quarters, support for him is strongest among those who go to church more, at least once a week. So the more devout they are, the more they support a man who, beyond the fact that he is demonstrably a racist, sexist, pathologically lying, lecherous, narcissistic sociopath. I mean, just beyond that, whose entire persona, whose entire worldview, whose entire 70 years of existence makes a mockery of Christianity, makes a mockery of the most core fundamental values of Christianity, it becomes very difficult to make sense of that.
I thought you were going to say core fundamental ideas of America, because
certainly
in
that.
So many ways yeah. they're one and the same.
No, absolutely. I mean, certainly that. But, you know, it's posed a religious conundrum, you know, not just for people like myself who study this kind of stuff and who try to make sense of what the hell is going on, but I think within evangelicalism as well, that what you are seeing is a real, no pun intended, soul searching that's been taking place to try to figure out what the hell is happening to this, the largest religious group in America. And I've written about this. I mean, I can give sort of my quick two cents about it. I think first of all, it's a number of things that we have to keep in mind. First, hopefully you noticed I kept saying white evangelicals. Yes, 81% of white evangelicals voted for Donald Trump. 67% of evangelicals of color supported Hillary Clinton. So these are evangelicals who believe the same thing, who have the same theology, but who just have a different skin tone. Mm-hmm. So let's not pretend that race doesn't have an aspect to this, right? There is a racial element to this white evangelical support. Partly it also has to do with the pernicious influence of the prosperity gospel. Over the last 20 years or so, those of you unfamiliar with the prosperity gospel, this is the drivel that is preached by these charlatans like Joel Osteen and T.D. Jakes, this idea that what God really wants for you is to drive a Bentley. Like, that's really God's master plan. And that material prosperity is a sign of God's blessings. This is the single fastest movement in American Christianity today. So it's not a small thing. It's gigantic. And now we are starting to see the influence of it. Because here's the thing. Donald Trump didn't have to do what everybody who runs for president, certainly every Republican who runs for president, has had to do, which is to actually prove his spiritual bona fides, right? This is a man who literally could not name a single verse in the Bible. Remember? He was asked, hey, what's your favorite book? Well, The Art of the Deal. But I guess the Bible is better, but just slightly better. And then he was asked, what's your favorite verse? And he said, I like all of them. So usually that's a non-starter for a group that calls itself value voters, mm-hmm. right? And yet, because he was rich, that was enough. That was a sign of God's blessings. And so he didn't have to prove it because he was wealthy. Thirdly, and I think this is probably the most consequential and dangerous aspect of it, is that Trump, in a way that I have never seen any Republican do, flat out explicitly promised his white evangelical base secular power in exchange for their support. See, Romney and McCain and the Bushes, everybody who has courted the evangelical vote has done it in exactly the same way. I share your values. It's as simple as that. You don't want abortion? I don't want abortion. You don't like gay marriage? I don't like gay marriage. We share the same values because we are of the same religion. It's a pretty easy argument to make. It's why evangelicals have flocked to Republicans, you know, really since the days of Reagan. Trump can't do that, you know? He can't look a bunch of evangelicals in the face and be like, we share the same values, you know, because he doesn't. And it's just, again, it's a sort of obvious and demonstrable that he doesn't.
So where's the separation of church and state coming in?
So this is very good, because what he said instead, and he did this, I mean, we have the transcripts of his talks to evangelical leaders and communities. What he said over and over again in those talks is, I am here to give you your power back. Your power has been taken from you, and I'm here to give it back to you. And he meant it in very stark terms. One of the very first things that he did as president was sign an executive order repealing the Johnson Amendment. Now, he couldn't do that because that's not how laws work. But in the House tax bill that is now on the verge of being reconciled with the Senate bill is the repeal of the Johnson Amendment. Now, if you don't know what the Johnson Amendment is, it's because you shouldn't. Because this is a thing that is about as uncontroversial as it gets. There is no sort of clamoring to get rid of the Johnson Amendment. It's not something that you should have heard of, because it's just something we all agree on. And the Johnson Amendment is that thing that forbids a pastor from standing at the pulpit and telling you to vote for Donald Trump. That they're not allowed to do that. Or they could lose their 501c3 status.
I care.
Yeah.
Well, people,
it's uncontroversial.
Yes. Everybody agrees.
Yes, there isn't some groundswell of like, wow, we really, if there's one thing we need to do in America is get rid of the Johnson Amendment.
So why was that such a big deal and so preeminent when he became president?
Well, two things. Because Franklin Graham and Pat Robertson and Tony Perkins and these evangelical leaders want that thing removed, because they already take part in political mm-hmm. activities. And this would remove all limitations from doing so. It would allow them to just turn their churches into voting booths, essentially. But it does one other particularly pernicious thing, which is that it now allows anyone to funnel millions, tens of millions of dollars, tax-free, into a church, and then have that money just go right into a politician's pocket. So you can go to temple and do your tithe, give $10 million to the temple with the understanding that the temple will take that money and just put it into Donald Trump's pocket, which is illegal right now and won't be illegal.
We haven't done that.
Yeah. that's extraordinary.
Yes, and very damning.
That is the downfall of any kind of separation of mm-hmm. church and state that we laud in the United States. That's the end of it.
Tell me something good about religion. No, tell me. Because you know, I saw your interview with Jon Stewart. I loved it, and one of the things you said is that you know religion, it gets a bad rap. God gets a bad rap most of the time.
Yeah.
And that, you know, there are so many people who are not religious in this country and want nothing to do with organized religion. What do you find as an American positive about religion in America?
I mean, look, religion is a man-made institution. And I mean that literally, as in people with penises. And as a man-made institution, it can be used for good and for bad. The civil rights movement was primarily a religious movement. The anti-war movement began as a religious movement. The anti-slavery movement, the abolitionist movement, was a religious movement. And so religion has the ability to transform societies for good. And it always has, and it will. And it can, I think. But as a man-made institution, it can also do as much evil as human beings are capable of doing. And so in a sense, religion is whatever religious people make of it. And so the reason that I was saying is that there is some hope for optimism is that all of the things that I just explained to you about what's happening with American evangelicalism, white evangelicalism, which is, again, the largest religious community in America. So it's not an insignificant mm-hmm. thing. We're talking about 100 to 150 million people, nearly half of us. Anywhere between a third and a half of us is what estimates say. And, you know, what is happening is that this has created this reckoning among evangelical leaders to figure out a way to respond to this bastardization of their religious faith. And it remains to be seen what comes out of this. But at least in that sense, I feel optimistic that what we are going to see is a new generation of religious leaders, not just evangelical leaders, but just faith leaders who, in response to the way in which their faith is being used to promote the dehumanization of individuals, are going to have to do what many of us have been loath to do, which is get off the damn fence and join the fight. And I've noticed that in the last year. I know you've noticed that in the last year in a way that I've never experienced before. To see people of different religions coming together and saying, forget about the things that divide us for a moment here. We are in an existential crisis. Mm-hmm. And how are we as people of faith going to respond to that? I think it's one of the most exciting things that's happening right now, and I think it's going to have an enormous impact on the next wave of elections.
Well, I share that optimism with you, and for all of our combined sons, my hope is that for the next generation, when I interview you again in 20 years, when it's goddess.
Yes.
That for the sake of our children, we'll be in a different place, and we'll be people of color, it'll be people of faith, it right. will be men and women together who are leading the charge to a better America. I definitely think people should take the opportunity to read both Zealot and God, and I will come full circle and say to you, you said, you know, we should have Thanksgiving together with all the religions in our family, and my Thanksgiving ended with my Episcopalian stepmother asking everybody at the table, what would happen if Jesus came back a second time? We couldn't talk about Trump, but we could talk about that.
Can I tell you?
I'll just tell you. Can tell me.
You tell me.
No, you tell me.
Because I get asked that question all the time. Like, people are like, what would Jesus think if he came back to Earth right now? What would he say? And my answer is, he would say, where's the synagogue? Because he's a Jew.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, my stepmother said, would we recognize the Messiah if the Messiah showed up? And I didn't say anything. She said, what would the rabbi say? And I said, the rabbi here would say, go look in the mirror. And then you'd know if the Messiah showed up. And I think it's the same thing that you say in your book. We're all the Messiah, and we're all God. Thank you very much. Reza Aslan.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was writer, commentator, and religious studies scholar Reza Aslan, whose new book is God, A Human History. He was joined in conversation by Rabbi Sidney Mintz. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.